Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Welcome back to Saved by the Blingy, the podcast. I am John DeBerry, and this is a podcast where we take a behind-the-scenes look at my cocktail book, Saved by the Blingy, which is a love letter to the 90s as told through a bunch of cocktail recipes. And this next interview is with someone who I consider to be a mentor and a tremendous influence of mine and a huge disinspiration. And I can't say enough good things about her. Her name is Julie Reiner. She is legendary in the cocktail world. She's responsible for such bars as Clover Club and Milady's, and she's written books, and she's just one of the titans of the bar industry. And when I was doing research for this book, I wanted to look at, obviously, 90s drinks, and one of the most iconic 90s drinks was the Appletini. And I was looking through New York Times archives, and I found this article from like the year, I think it was like 99 or 2000, and lo and behold, she's one of the sources in this article about the Appletini, and she goes into her recipe and everything. So I thought it'd be really cool to bring her on and talk to her about her experience working as a bartender in the 90s, as well as kind of her specific take on the Appletini, which does show up in my book as a sort of modernized-ish version of the Appletini that she was talking about. And Julie is, yeah, again, I never worked for her as a bartender, but I kind of feel like she's really important to me as an inspiration and sort of as a guide in my own career. So I think that probably my fangirling over her maybe comes off in this interview. And so I hope you'll enjoy it. Cheers. Okay. Well, Julie, thanks so much for joining me. It's a pleasure to talk to you. I feel like, you know, we've been friends for a while, but the reason why I wanted to have you come on and chat with me today is because when I was doing my research on the Appletini, I was digging back into the New York Times archives, and there was this article about the Appletini from, I think it was like June 2000. And I was reading all about it, and then there was a quote from you in it about like what, you know, what people were drinking and what, you know, kind of what it was like to be serving this drink at this time. And, you know, my book wasn't really about drinks that appeared in the 90s. It was more about like pop culture in the 90s, but the Appletini is kind of considered to be one of the most, iconic 90s-y cocktails out there. And so I had to include it, and, you know, and then hearing, you know, one of my mentors and someone who I really look up to quoted in an article about it, this made it all the more, you know, salient for me. So I just want to, you know, kind of hear from you about, you know, both about like what kind of the Appletini sort of like was for you, you know, back when you were serving it. And then maybe also just talk a little bit about bar culture in the 90s. Cause I think that I'm learning that the kind of 90s being the dark ages of cocktails is sort of a little bit of a revisionist history, and chatted with Toby Ciccini last week, and he had a pretty like strong stance for the 90s actually being pretty solid in terms of cocktail bartending. So I just love to hear your take on all that too. So I guess why don't we start with the Appletini? And
yeah, well, I'll tell you my story of how it came to be. You know, and I think that, you know, the 90s, what it really was that there was such a wide span of what people were doing behind bars. I mean, for the most part, right, it was like sour mix on the gun and, you know, Rose's lime juice and nothing of high quality necessarily. you know, in most places, but then there were pockets of things happening and where people were like, oh, you know, I can put fresh juice in this and it tastes so much better. And, you know, the realization that wow, using fresh fruit actually makes a delicious drink. So, you know, those were all like brand new ideas that were just sort of starting at the time. But I was managing the bar at C3, and a woman by the name of Kate Monig, actually, who was an actress, who later was on The L Word, she used to come in to C3, and she had come back from L.A., and she sat at the bar. She's like, hey, I had this apple martini in L.A., and it was so good. Can you make an apple martini? And she was like, one of these like very dynamic lesbian women. I was like, for you, of course. but I had never had one. And I was like, well, let's see, you know, if I were to make an apple martini, how would I want it to taste? And I just sort of thought to myself, right, I was like, I would want it to taste like I was biting into an apple, but with a kick, you know? And apple pucker existed, but I didn't know it existed and I had never tasted it. So what I did was I took Granny Smith green apples and I infused them into vodka, and I basically just had a bucket and I let it sit in Granny Smith green apples for like a week and a half. And then I strained that out, which gave me this really delicious apple tasting vodka, you know? You know, at that time also, it was like a lot of these flavored vodkas that were out there just tasted very artificial and not very good. So, so I started with that, and then I took that and I added a little bit of a pomo to it, and a splash of, and like, I think I stirred that and strained it and then topped it with like a little bit of Martinelli's apple cider, just to pull out the apple even more. And then I floated an apple slice in it. And that was my apple martini. You know, and suddenly, yeah, Rick Marin from the New York Times was asking people, you know, around the office, have you heard about this apple martini? Because, you know, the word of this drink being huge in LA, I guess, had traveled to New York. And somebody in the office was like, oh, there's this girl at this bar called C3, and she makes this really awesome one, and it's very bright and fresh and actually right, tastes like apples and not like a watermelon Jolly Rancher. And so he came in and then he wrote about it. And that was sort of like, you know, it was a turning point in my career. You know, it was the first time I was in the New York Times. And, you know, Dale DeGroff, I guess, saw it and also heard that I was doing some things because he was at a theater right next door to C3, which was in the West Village on Waverly and McDougal. And he came in and was like, hey, kid, what are you doing? and I didn't, I was like, who are you? I don't know who you are. So that was how I met Dale. But yeah, that was basically the story of my apple martini. And then I, you know, came to understand, oh, this apple pucker stuff. And then I was like, well, mine is so much better. So that was sort of, you know, the trajectory of kind of how I thought about drinks and how I created cocktails. And, you know, I was really doing a lot of, you know, my own syrups and just trying to take a more culinary approach to cocktails,
right,
which in New York City at that time you didn't really see very often. As opposed to San Francisco, where, you know, I moved to New York from San Francisco in 1997, where I had been bartending, and, you know, fresh juice and, you know, recipes for specific drinks was common in San Francisco at the time. But when I got to New York, you know, New York at that point was very much behind San Francisco when it came to the quality of the cocktails that were being served over bars.
That's interesting. So when you came to New York in 97, like what was that, like where did you first start working? And was it something where like, you know, I feel like there's kind of a trope of like when you've started a new place and you're like, well, my old place, we did it this way. And people kind of resent you for it. Was it sort of like a culture shock?
Well, I mean, honestly, it was more like, you know, in San Francisco, there were a lot of women behind the bar. And so I, you know, I was bartending at some various places in San Francisco. And then when I got to New York, every place I went into, you know, they were like, oh, are you sure you don't want a cocktail waitress? You know, and trying to find an actual, bartending job, you know, because it was all men behind the bar and all male managers. And, you know, I basically had to say, hey, I can bartend circles around these guys. Why don't you just put me back there and I'll show you?
yeah.
So, I worked at a place called Bayamo, which was a Chino Latino spot on Broadway, very close to NYU, which has been a clothing store or something for years now. But that was the first spot I was at.
Oh, is that the place with the neon awning?
I don't, with all the, I don't the lights. Remember if it had a neon awning, but it was like, it was close to like Waverly and Broadway, you know, it was right there.
Right.
So that was one of the first spots that I was at. And then I was also at a place called La Strega that was like an Italian restaurant in Soho. And before I got the job at C3, where a friend of mine from San Francisco was the general manager of the restaurant. So she reached out and was like, hey, I need a bar manager. Do you want to come and, you know, check it out? And it was such a cool spot. It's still there. And, you know, it was just like this tiny little bar in the back of, you know, there was a restaurant in the front and the bar is in the back. And you had to walk through the restaurant to get to the bar. And so, you know, that was sort of ultimately, you know, where I ended up being for quite a while until I got too much press. And then I thought it was my job. I thought that it was my job to make the bar busy and to make them money. But what it turned out was that, you know, the owner, her family owned the hotel, the Washington Square Hotel. And so it was sort of like, the restaurant and bar was almost like just a toy for her, you know? Mm. They were like, here you go, honey. Here's a restaurant for you. But they made all their money on the rooms, you know? And so when I started getting all this press for the drinks that I was doing, all of, you know, New Yorkers want the best of everything. So right. They would come in and, you know, and walk. So it became like a walkway through the restaurant to get to the bar in the back, which really upset the chef and the GM. and then I was making a ton of money, which also upset the chef and the GM. So they went to the owner and they told her that I was going to open my own place and steal all of her clientele. And I got fired for doing too good of a job.
Wow.
Quote, in front of the chef and the restaurant manager, which was also so weird. That's like Dale's favorite story. Julie gets fired for getting too much press.
For being too good.
Yeah.
That is really funny. And so that's, and after that firing, was that sort of the process that began what ended up opening Flatiron or?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I had been talking to, you know, one of my friends who was in San Francisco, and she was the head bartender at the Red Room, which was a bar that I learned how to bartend at. And she was from New York. Her mom owned a bar in the West Village called Fanny's Oyster Bar or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, at Michelle Connolly. And so we started talking about getting a place open here. And she had some friends who owned the Zinc Bar, which was on Houston and Worcester. And so she decided that she would help. And we, you know, started working on getting a place open.
Cool.
And that was Flatiron Lounge, which we opened in 2003.
Yeah. Wow. Cool. So we're actually going to take a quick break, and we're going to be right back with more from Julie.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
And we're back with Julie. And Julie, I'm really curious to hear, like, kind of like, you know, I sort of consciously avoided a lot of, like, you know, cocktail history in my book, but I'm kind of using this podcast as to a way to explore, like, kind of what drinking culture, I mean, not drinking culture, but really cocktail and, like, craft cocktail culture was like in the 90s. And I'm just curious to hear, like, are there, you know, the Appletini obviously is sort of like one of the hallmarks and kind of like what people throw out now when they're talking about 90s drinks. But are there other, like, cocktails from that era that, you know, you think deserve some, you know, either rehabilitation or rediscovery, the way that some of these drinks have already?
I mean, there are only so many, you know.
Right.
I do feel like, you know, Simon Ford and I were talking the other day because we're doing a seminar together at the Rome Bar Show about, like, cocktail culture in the 90s and 2000s. And we were talking about the Stoli Doli, which was, like, there was certainly, like, this move towards infusions that occurred where people mm-hmm. were like, oh, you know, I worked at the Capitol Grill in San Francisco for a while. And, like, they had, like, this giant thing on the bar that we would cut and fill with pineapple and then pour vodka over it. And then we would just, it had a tap on the bottom and you would just take some out, shake it up and serve it, you know, which was like a pineapple martini basically.
Right.
But you saw a lot of that, which I think is interesting because that was sort of like the beginning of this, like, utilization of fresh ingredients and, you know, infusing them or macerating them with booze, you know, and that was certainly something that kind of started in that, in the early 90s. But as far, you know, I mean, it was a lot of, like, Long Island iced teas and Cosmos and woo-woos and, you know, a lot
What's
of those
woo-woo?
Kind of. Oh, vodka, peach schnapps, and cranberry juice.
Of
which,
course it is.
You know, yeah. I mean, in our effort to, like, try to resurrect some of these 90s drinks, and that drink had such a fun name. You know, I was like, oh, maybe we can, like, remake the woo-woo and actually make it taste good.
Make it good.
But I
yeah.
had to, like, I had to nix that. I was like, no, it still tastes like shit. Yeah.
Oh, that's hilarious. And so it's interesting about, like, you had a request from a guest and they had a West Coast experience with a drink. And then you sort of, you know, reconstructed the Appletini from, not from a memory of tasting it, but just from sort of like how you think a drink that's like apple and martini should taste. Like, cause
right.
you'd imagine at the time, you know, you'd think that, like, what people would be clamoring for is, like, De Kuyper, you know, sour apple, you know, all the sorts of, like, liqueurs plus a little bit of vodka, maybe some sour mix. And that sort of, like, sounds like a sort of stereotypical 90s version of the Appletini. But your version seemed to be quite, like, you could throw that on a menu today and people would be like, well, that's, you know, that drink just came about like 2 years ago. You know, it feels very up to date.
Totally. Well, which is what I did at Milady's.
Right.
You know,
right.
Except that what we ended up doing, so I took that original recipe and I was like, you know what, I want to revamp this because Milady's had, you know, was a dive that was there for mm-hmm. so long and was open at that time. And I used to go there after bartending at C3, you know, but what we ended up doing was we infused the Granny Smith green apples into gin and vodka. Mm. And then, you know, we used like a little bit of apple brandy in it. So we, you know, we kept the basic sort of form of the drink, but updated it a little but it still has that same, the goal of what was, you know, bright, fresh apple, but still a martini. And then we used green glitter to make it look like
Great.
A pucker martini, but
yes.
It drinks like an actual classy apple martini.
Glitter is definitely called for in that.
Oh yeah, yeah. We have like two different colors of green that we put in there along with the glitter to make it super fun and look. It looks like the 90s.
Yeah, exactly. And so I feel like you could make a case that you were kind of the inventor of the Apple Teenie, but it seems like it's sort of like a lineage of a recipe that sort of existed in the past, and you put like a sophisticated kind of craft cocktail spin on it. Do you have any knowledge of like where this drink actually was like originated, or is it just one of those kind of folk things? Like a lot of the cocktail histories where it's just sort of like, if you look too far in the past, it just all gets kind of hazy.
Yeah, I have no idea. I mean, you know, and honestly, like, I don't care to argue with people about it either,
right?
Because I'm just like, whatever. I don't need credit. I mean, you know, I think that article that Rick Marin did was like the first one of its kind, and there were other people who also were doing, you know, some cool apple martinis that were written about in that.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, as far as I know, like the Pucker one seems to have originated in LA, you know, just from what I know at the time. And I think it also, you know, if you look into when Apple Pucker was released, you know, because that was really what it was sort of centered around.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. But I mean, at C3, like, you know, the woman who owned it was really into wine, and she had a lot of like esoteric spirits on the back bar that I had never seen and that weren't in a lot of bars. There were eau de vies that she had, mezcal. Like there was some cool stuff that I had never seen. And, you know, a funny story about that bar, Ted Hay, who, you know, who wrote, Forgotten Cocktails and was a cocktail historian. He was there. He was in New York City shooting a movie called Riding in Cars with Girls with Drew Barrymore. And he was staying at the Washington Square Hotel, and he would come into the bar every night after he was done shooting, because he'd be on the set telling them, oh no, that is 1955. And that plate is 1962. You know, and he would come in and he'd sit at the bar and he would point at various bottles on the back bar and say, make me a drink with that, like some raspberry eau de vie, you know, or, you know, these were things that I really had never grabbed for on the back bar, but he would come in and push me to make something with these bottles. And then he would drink them no matter whether they were good or not. But he really like pushed me to try and do different things, you know? So Ted Hay was certainly, you know, partially responsible for my growth as a bartender at that time.
Yeah, I love that. I mean, the fact that you included Pomo in the apple martini is pretty cool.
Yeah, because it was something that was on the back bar that, you know, I mean, I have some photos of me working that bar, and I, you know, like I've zoomed in to be like, look at these things that were there. Nobody else had them, you know?
Yeah.
It was some cool stuff.
Yeah. I mean, maybe this is a tough question to answer, but like, are there, you know, I think that like, you know, it's easy to say that like bartending has come a long way, in the past, you know, 20 years, you know, the craft cocktail kind of like quote revival and all the speakeasies and the fact that you can now get a really decent Negroni pretty much anywhere you go. Is there anything from the 90s, like either just like from like a technique perspective or like an attitude or, you know, we talked about ingredients, but like, you know, anything that kind of like that you think that we kind of lost from that era that like should be sort of embraced or resurrected?
Oh gosh. I mean, not that I can, not that I can think of.
Okay, that's a good answer.
I mean, you know, it was not exactly a time for high quality drinks at most places, you know.
Right.
I mean, there why really wasn't.
Why do you think that is? Do you think that they just like cared more about volume or?
Well, I think it's a combo of things. Chefs at that time were not supportive of bartenders at all.
Right.
I mean, as a sweeping generalization, like they were like, you know, I'm the star, and you know, which was part of the reason that the chef was so mad, you know, at C3. It was just like I'm supposed to be the star of the restaurant, you know? And so that was just sort of the mentality of chefs at the time. And so there was a lack of culinary support with the bar, and also mm-hmm. just like owners not understanding, you know, why you would want to put more money into drinks when you could just use Rosie's lime juice and sell. It's just, it's easy to be lazy and use shitty ingredients, and people didn't know any better, you know?
Exactly.
I mean, you only know what a good margarita tastes like when you have one, and then
after
suddenly you're like,
one.
Oh,
yeah.
I can't ever have one of these, you know, something from some bottle that you buy at the store that's like margarita mix, you know?
Right.
So it wasn't until people had these drinks, you know, which was what made Flatiron Lounge such an instant success. It was just, they would come in and be like, oh my God, this is the best drink I've ever had. And it yeah. wasn't like we were, you know, there was not a ton of like mind-blowing cocktails necessarily, but we were using fresh squeezed juices and syrups and bitters, and then we were measuring our drinks and, you know, looking to classic recipes to try to, you know, elevate the level of quality behind the bar. And once Flatiron Lounge opened, and, you know, at that time it was sort of like Milk and Honey was open, mm-hmm. but even, you know, Sasha wasn't really doing what Sasha ended up doing at that time, you
right.
know, when he first opened, you know, you talked to Dale, like when he first opened, it was like a coffee shop and he had some drinks, but it wasn't the level of quality that he ultimately became known for there. That was something that, you know, he was learning, you know, and implementing, you know, around that same time. But Milk and Honey was so tiny and
right.
it was hard to get into and, you know. But shortly after that, you know, suddenly there were other bars that opened, and Audrey was
right.
working
Pegu.
With Dale. And after, you know, the Rainbow Room closed, and then Dale went to Blackbird, and then Audrey, you know, was at a couple different bars. And like Dale sent Audrey and I on some celebrity bartender thing, you know, that we went and worked together at an event. And it was sort of like this small group of people, all who cared about putting the best thing they possibly could in a glass, that we all kind of started meeting one another. You know, and it was Eben Clem and Eben Freeman, and there was just a handful of us, that we would go to each other's bars. And, you know, Sushi Samba was actually a spot that they were muddling everything. But it was cool because it was actually fresh, you know?
Right.
So yeah, I mean, that was kind of the way that it was. And then it quickly, into the early 2000s, it quickly increased as more people came in, tried
yeah.
these drinks, and then were like, oh, we should do that too. You know, the employees only guys were sitting mm-hmm. at the bar at Flatiron when they were getting ready to open, employees only. And, you know, so
yeah.
it quickly multiplied.
Yeah, that's super interesting, just like the way that the kind of the momentum build in the early 2000s.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I tell people all the time too, it's like, they're, you know, so much for me was like the right place, the right time, the right idea,
mm-hmm.
you know, because I could have opened Flatiron Lounge or did what I was doing at C3, you know, at a bar in middle America somewhere, and nobody would have cared, but it was New York City, which is global. So, you know, it grew very fast.
Right. You had that stage. All right. Well, thank you so much for chatting with me. It's really interesting getting to hear more about, the Appletini and everything. So, yeah, thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you, John.
Saved by the Bellini is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The Comedian Who Ranks Apples Using an Elaborate 100-Point System, The Secret History of Grocery Stores, and How to Eat Your Way Through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.